Imagine you are standing on a stage in front of this totally packed room.
Yeah.
Okay.
Setting the scene. I like it.
Yeah. And three complete strangers have just yelled out completely random, unpredictable pieces of information. So, like, the make of a car, a random color, and I don't know, the loose change in their pockets.
Right. Totally spontaneous stuff.
Exactly. And yet, sitting in a sealed envelope on a table nearby, an envelope that has literally been in plain sight this entire time, is a handwritten letter that perfectly predicts every single word they just said.
Which is just wild to even think about.
It is. So the question is, how is your brain being hacked right in that moment?
Well, it feels like magic, obviously, but what you are actually experiencing is a highly engineered hijacking of your attention and your assumptions, really.
Oh, completely.
Like, you think you are tracking the reality of the room, but your focus is being manipulated on a physiological level.
Yes. Welcome to the Deep Dive, everyone. Our mission today is to explore that hidden architecture of human attention.
It's a fun one today.
It really is. We are deconstructing a literal masterclass in psychological deception. We're looking at this highly specialized instructional text for mentalists. It's called Confabulating Confabulation, and it's written by Quentin Reynolds.
And we should probably establish our premise right away for you listening. On the surface, I mean, this document is a how-to guide for a specific stage illusion.
Right, it teaches a magic trick.
Yeah, exactly. But if you read between the lines, it is actually this incredible blueprint for elite problem solving.
Oh, 100%.
By understanding how a performer like Reynolds engineers a flawless deception, you can learn an immense amount about storytelling, cognitive load, and, well, how to absolutely command an audience's focus in your own life.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because to really appreciate how Reynolds revolutionizes this illusion, we kind of have to understand the foundational trick he's trying to fix.
The baseline.
Right, the legacy code, so to speak. The foundational effect is a classic piece of mentalism known simply as confabulation.
And the baseline effect is exactly what you described in the opening. The performer asks for three random details from the audience, right?
Yeah.
Then they pull out their wallet, open it up, and extract a sealed envelope. And inside that envelope is a small folded piece of paper with a prediction that flawlessly matches the audience's spontaneous choices.
Which just sounds impossible. Like, how?
Right.
But Reynolds points out that under the hood, the traditional mechanics of this trick are actually incredibly clunky.
Oh, very clunky.
It relies on this thing called double writing. So usually there's a hidden piece of carbon paper that the performer secretly scribbles on while pretending to do something else entirely.
Which, as you can imagine, forces the performer to move in naturally. I mean, it requires these stiff, awkward hand postures that, even if the audience doesn't know what's happening, subtly signal that something suspicious is going on.
Yeah, your brain just picks up on the weirdness.
Where?
Plus, the prediction paper itself is tiny. If you're performing for a big crowd, pulling out this little scrap of paper lacks, like, visual authority.
It looks like a grocery receipt.
Exactly. It doesn't look like a grand, impressive prediction. But honestly, my absolute favorite critique Reynolds makes is just pure logic. Like, why on earth would a letter be inside a
What?
wallet?
Right. It makes no sense. Letters come in the mail. They live in normal envelopes, not, crammed next to your gym membership card.
Yeah, exactly.
To a critical observer, that illogical detail is a loose thread. And once they pull on it, the whole illusion just starts to unravel.
And to really drive home why these clunky mechanics are so fatal to a presentation, Reynolds includes this brilliant piece of historical context. He reprints an article from a 1948 issue of a magazine called Pentagram.
A great magazine for mentalists back in the day.
Yeah, and it was written by a legendary stage mentalist named Al Caron. And Caron was just ruthless about the state of his industry at the time.
What's fascinating here is how Caron articulates the fundamental philosophy of performance. He believed that mentalism, or really any presentation of incredible information, must be, quote, alive, real, and above all, a fact.
I love that quote.
He complained bitterly that most performers treated their audiences to these slow, confusing puzzles instead of actual magic.
Yeah, he actually timed a guy. He watched another performer do a prediction routine, and it took 7.5 minutes before the audience gave their first reaction.
Wow.
7.5 minutes. That is an absolute eternity on a stage.
It's awful. It is the theatrical equivalent of like a business pitch where the presenter spends the first 10 minutes fumbling with HDMI cables and clicking through text-heavy background slides.
Yes, you've completely lost them.
We've lost them before you've even started. Quran argued that the audience needs an immediate, visceral experience. He wrote, in the first contact with his audience, the mentalist must immediately convince them of his power.
Right.
No twisting and turning the thinking power until it is lost.
Twisting the thinking power until it's lost. That is just such a great description of cognitive fatigue.
It really is.
So we know the classic trick is theoretically brilliant, but mechanically flawed, right? It relies on carbon paper and a wallet, which slows things down and creates suspicion. So how does Reynolds systematically re-engineer this to be bulletproof? Let's dive into the mechanical fix.
Well, Reynolds attacks the critique systematically. So first, to fix the size issue, he ditches the tiny scrap of paper and uses a full standard A4 sized letter.
Which is huge.
Yeah, it has physical weight. It looks important. And then to fix the wallet logic problem, he borrows an idea from another performer named Paul LaPaul.
Ah, right. Instead of a wallet, Reynolds brings out a thick bundle of real normal-looking envelopes held together with a simple rubber band. And he leaves this bundle in full view on a table right at the start of the show.
He's so smart.
It is. The logic is suddenly flawless. Where do you find a letter? Bundled up with the rest of the post, it completely normalizes the objects in play.
But the biggest hurdle is still the carbon paper. And Reynolds makes a pretty radical decision here. He eliminates the double writing entirely.
He just gets rid of it.
Yeah. He decides he is going to write the audience's choices directly onto the actual final prediction paper.
Okay, well, wait, I have to push back here on behalf of anyone listening. If he's not using carbon paper and he's writing the audience's answers directly onto the final prediction letter, he has to be doing it right in front of them while they're staring at him.
Correct.
So how on earth do they not notice that he is literally writing the prediction in real time?
Because of a highly engineered piece of physical camouflage, Reynolds creates something he calls the notepad. But it isn't a notepad at all.
No, it's not.
It is a custom-built visual shield designed specifically to hide the folded prediction paper.
Okay, walk us through this because the geometry is wild and I want to make sure I'm visualizing this correctly. He takes the A4 prediction letter and he folds it. Wait, the text says he folds it into thirds and then ninths?
Yeah.
Do you mean he folds it like a tic-tac-toe board? So there are 9 equal squares total.
That is the perfect analogy, yes. A 3x3 grid. He folds it horizontally into thirds and then vertically into thirds. So you are left with a compact square made of 9 panels.
Okay, following so far.
And the magic happens on panel number 8, which is the bottom center square.
Got it. So while the rest of the paper might have a fake letterhead or pre-printed text, panel 8 is completely blank. That is his writing surface.
Precisely. But, you know, he can't just stand on stage holding a weirdly folded piece of paper and writing on one little square. That would look bizarre.
Yeah, obviously.
So he builds the fake notepad around it to provide context. He takes a thick piece of stiff cardboard that is just slightly narrower and slightly longer than panel 8. Then he attaches a thinner front cover and a back cover to it.
And the genius is in the offset sizing of those covers. It's basically like a set of stairs. The front cover is slightly shorter than the stiff middle card, and the back cover is slightly longer.
Yes.
So when you hold it, those steps create a little hidden lip.
Which means when he slides that folded tic-tac-toe paper into the gimmick, sandwiching the stiff middle card just behind panel 8, the edges of the prediction paper are completely hidden by that lip.
That is so clever.
From the audience's perspective, he is just holding a cheap, ordinary little office notebook. The longer back cover shields the top of the folded paper, and his hand naturally covers the side.
He is literally writing the final prediction in plain sight. It's brilliant because it hides the secret right out in the open. Oh. If he forgets what the audience called out, he just looks down at the pad and asks them to repeat it.
Exactly.
He's playing the role of a guy taking notes. But, I mean, even with a perfect mechanical shield, if you just stand there staring intensely at a notepad, people are going to zero in on your hand.
All right. The how is the notepad. Yeah. But the why they don't see it relies entirely on storytelling and misdirection. The mechanics must be completely cloaked by narrative.
And the story he uses is pure gold. It's the Irish granny script. Instead of just doing a dry, boring prediction of a car and a color, he tells the audience he's using a letter sent to him by his Irish granny who lives in a town called Ballyslobodá Shoachrí in West Cork.
It is an absurd tongue-twisting name that immediately breaks the tension in the room.
And the details he weaves in are hilarious. He says Granny recently came into some money and opened West Cork's only exotic dancing club. But because of her age, he clarifies, it's more like exotic shuffling.
Which gets a laugh, of course.
Right. He also asked the audience how much money they think Granny sent him in the letter, giving them options of 10, 20, 30, 40, or 50 euro.
He even includes a running joke about a medical condition. He tells the audience he recently developed a rash in his nether regions and asks someone what remedy Granny might prescribe.
And someone usually shouts out, gin. And he asks how long it will take to clear up, and they say, 3 weeks. It turns the whole routine into this interactive, silly conversation. But why is the humor so crucial here? It's not just about being entertaining, right?
No, not at all.
There is a structural purpose to the jokes.
Exactly. From a cognitive science perspective, humor is incredibly strategic. It leverages cognitive load theory. Processing a joke, visualizing an exotic shuffling club, and laughing, that requires a significant amount of brain power.
It's distracting.
Completely.
Yeah. Agree.
When an audience is laughing, their critical faculties are temporarily suspended. They are experiencing an emotion, which means they are not analyzing the physical space.
They aren't looking for the carbon paper or wondering about the thickness of the notepad. They are just enjoying the ride.
Reynolds actually includes a specific gag where he shows the audience a postcard of two young goats, referring to them as my sister's kids.
Oh, that's terrible. I love it.
Right. The audience laughs at the pun. And because they are laughing, they succumb to inattentional blindness. They are looking right at him, but they aren't registering his hands.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting. Because while they are laughing at the goat postcard, Reynolds executes what he calls the sneaky bit.
The best part.
This is the physical choreography where he detaches the prediction paper and loads it into the envelope. And it happens in a fraction of a second, completely out in the open.
And it relies on weaponizing a deep-seated social norm, the handshake.
He invites a volunteer from the audience. He calls her Alice in the text up to the stage. As she is walking up, he closes the front cover of his fake notepad. He grips the sides, pulls it down slightly, and flips it end over end.
Just a casual movement.
Yeah. But in that one fluid motion, he folds the prediction paper in half again. So it is now completely detached from the core of the notepad, but perfectly hidden under his left hand.
To the audience, it just looks like he absentmindedly flipped his notebook face down. But the real genius is what happens next.
Right. He picks up that bundle of envelopes from the table with his right hand. Alice arrives beside him. And what is the inescapable social obligation when someone joins you on stage?
You shake their hand.
Exactly. We are hardwired to comply with that social script. It's like a physical reflex.
Completely automatic.
So, to free up his right hand to shake hers, he places the bundle of envelopes onto his left hand, right over the secretly hidden prediction paper. They shake hands. Then he simply lifts the notepad straight up with his right hand and gives it to Alice to hold.
Leaving the folded prediction paper sitting flush against the bundle of envelopes, perfectly positioned to be slid inside.
It's seamless.
It is. And the audience misses the move entirely because of a biological phenomenon called saccadic masking.
Saccadic masking. Okay. Explain that.
Yeah. So when your eyes move rapidly from one point to another, like darting from the performer's face to the volunteer's face or down to the shaking hands, your brain actually shuts off visual processing for a few milliseconds to prevent motion blur.
Wait, really? It just shuts off?
Literally. In that tiny window of literal blindness, and under the cover of the social obligation to look at the person you are greeting, the dirty work is done. The mechanics are shielded by biology and etiquette.
Wow. It's beautiful. It's like a perfectly choreographed dance where you only see the steps they want you to see, and your own brain is helping them hide the rest.
Exactly.
But Reynolds doesn't stop there. He has to ensure the audience can never, ever reverse engineer what just happened when they drive home that night.
Which brings us to the psychological masterstroke of the entire routine, the kicker ending.
This blew my mind when I read it. Remember earlier when the audience guessed how much money Granny sent? 10, 20, 30, 40, or 50 euro?
Yes, that seemingly random detail in the story.
Well, Reynolds actually has real euro banknotes pre-folded inside those envelopes on the table. He has different bundles prepared. So if the audience guesses 30 euro, he uses the specific envelope bundle that already has a 10 and a 20 euro note hidden inside the prediction envelope.
So when Alice finally opens the envelope and reads the letter to the crowd, she doesn't just find the written prediction of the money. She physically pulls out the exact amount of cash they guessed.
But like, why go to all that trouble? The written prediction is already incredibly impressive. Why add the physical cash?
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, it is about creating a massive logical disconnect. Think about it from the audience's perspective. If they try to deconstruct the trick later, they might logically deduce, okay, maybe he had a secret way to write our answers on the paper at the last second while he was holding that notepad.
Right. That's the only rational explanation.
But the physical money short-circuits that entire line of deductive reasoning. They think, wait, he couldn't have just written it at the last second because there was actual physical cash matching our guess sealed inside the envelope along with the letter.
Because you can't secretly write a 20-euro bill into existence. It's physically impossible.
Exactly. The presence of physical money retroactively proves to their brains that the envelope must have been prepared and sealed long before the show even started.
Oh, that is so devious.
It destroys the only logical path they have to figure out the method. It adds a layer of absolute credibility by being so physically undeniable.
So what does this all mean for you, the listener? Why did we just spend this deep dive dissecting a stage magic trick?
Good question.
Well, if you look at the very end of Reynolds' document, past all the mechanics of the scripts, he includes advertisements for his other works, and the titles kind of give away the game.
They really do.
One is called How to Present Yourself to an Audience, and another is The Shields Effect, which is a manual on how to become a headliner and generate massive audience reactions.
It reveals the true intent behind the text. I mean, this isn't just about fooling people with a piece of paper. It is an advanced study in capturing, directing, and holding human attention.
Absolutely. Whether you are prepping for a crucial boardroom meeting, writing a persuasive essay, or pitching a new idea to a client, you are, in a sense, performing a routine. You are presenting a reality you want them to buy into.
And you have to ask yourself, what is the carbon paper in your presentation? What are the clunky legacy code mechanics in your arguments that are slowing you down and causing your audience to become suspicious or bored?
Yeah. Are you treating your audience to a confusing 7.5-minute puzzle?
Right. Or are you delivering an immediate, convincing experience?
To truly connect with an audience, you have to systematically engineer your presentation to remove friction. You wrap your core data, your panel 8, in engaging storytelling.
Exactly. You use humor to relax their critical faculties, just like the Irish granny script. You use the social norms, the boardroom equivalents of the handshake, to guide their focus exactly where you want it.
You are hiding your mechanics in plain sight. When you understand how a mentalist engineers an illusion, it just completely shifts how you think about standing in front of a room.
It really does. Which leaves us with one final thought for you to mull over today.
Let's hear it.
We've talked a lot about stage performers and boardroom presentations, but this raises an important question about the digital spaces we inhabit every day. Think about the social media algorithms that feed your timelines.
Oh, wow.
They are the ultimate modern mentalists.
Oh, that is a wild comparison. How so?
Well, next time you find yourself endlessly scrolling, completely captivated by a feed, ask yourself how these same principles are being applied to you. The platforms give us the comedy, the memes, the funny videos to lower our cognitive load and relax our critical faculties.
They're giving us the goat postcard.
Exactly. They give us the social handshakes, the likes, the notifications, the obligations to respond, which creates saccadic masking, blinding us to the bigger picture.
While they're quietly folding the prediction paper of our purchasing habits and attention spans right behind the scenes.
Exactly. They are engineering an illusion of free choice while the outcome is already sealed in the envelope. So ask yourself, where is the digital storyteller deliberately drawing your eye? And what mechanics are they hiding in plain sight?
Transparency is rarely as transparent as it seems. Thank you so much for taking this deep dive with us today. It's been an absolute blast unpacking the hidden architecture of attention with you. Until next time, keep your eyes open, and we'll catch you on the next deep dive.